can just shoot some questions here. How's that?
Yeah, I mean, trends is a very broad question, so I was trying to interpret when you say what are the trends, because one of the things that first came to my mind was budget. The state budget trend, when you look at the budget trend over the last 3 years, it's been, very negative, declining, and that's having a tremendous impact. Actually, this year, I think we're really, at least in my view, obviously we've been feeling it the last several years, but this year I feel that it's really having an impact, and if we were to experience similar declines in budgets over the next year or two, it's going to really, really be difficult. And we're currently looking at, there's a phrase that everyone loves to use. That is, let's keep the cuts away from the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I think that phrase has gone out the window now. I think that it's unrealistic to even talk about that. So that's a trend. One of the trends is that we are at a point now in Madison where everyone's coming to us saying, don't cut me. But everyone's going to get cut now. It's hard for me to. I can't lie about it. I mean, it's that's where we are, and it's like, well, what about cut over there, but not here? And that's a trend that's very troubling to me.
I think just picking up on that, the class sizes are, they're going up. The way we're allocating class sizes, it's not dramatic, but it's been over the course. It's gone up in the past, and it continues to go up. It's not like we're adding five kids at every class to every grade level, but it's if we change the formula just a little bit this year, there's, two more kids over there and two more kids over there, and next year again, there's four kids there. And this has been going on for about 10, 12 years. But this year, it's very conscious, the changes, and particularly around the K-3 classes. And those are some places where we try to protect, especially in our high poverty schools and our SAGE schools. So the budget stuff is real, and just to point out that with the exception of 1 year when we did major, and this was before my time, when there were major investments done in a reading program, this is the first year since the 2008 referendum when we don't have unused revenue authority. And so that means if we come down to, as we're doing changes in budgeting, we come down, we can't say, well, we'll just tax more anymore. I mean, we don't have that. And that's the other trend with this stuff is that increasingly the reliance on local taxation as opposed to state funding. And especially when we have a growing, one of the trends, this kicks into another trend, is the growing number of English language learners. And, there was a time when the state federal combined reimbursements on those were well over 30%. We're down bopping around 20% now. With a growing population, and that puts a strain on everything. It's just, and it's not pitting anybody against each other, it just puts a strain on budgets. But that's another serious trend we have in our district, is
do you want to come and join us?
we're talking up here.
Yeah.
Small group.
I'm Dean.
Keep it into
TJ.
Dean Thorbackus.
We know each other. We've knocked doors together.
We have. I remember that.
We've knocked doors. That was
let
a good
me,
day.
Before you get going anymore, let me kind of contribute to your first thoughts around budget, and in a little different way, is I think that policymakers at the highest levels of the state are flat out lying to people about what when they say that they support education. I think they're just flat out lying. What they would rather support is a shift of public dollars towards privatized systems, not only just in education, but in healthcare, in state parks, in utilities, in everything down the line, in prisons, which has already been done, and even more. They would prefer to just shift everything over to some private corporation and hand out vouchers or something and say, that's it, you're on your own. That is what a trend in actual, what seems to be a reason behind the way this budget is coming out. And I think that from my perspective, hopefully more people are beginning to flat out recognize that lie and seeing it for what it is. And I think one of the reasons that I believe that more people are recognizing it is that the enormous number of, with TJ, of referendums for operations, not for what we did last year for fixing up our buildings, which is needed every once in a while, but this is just to keep their school system going. And frankly, we're going to be talking about that very soon.
So what I'm hearing, actually, can I throw two more other trends on the table, which I think are very important?
You
I was going to reflect on what
sure.
you said.
No problem.
One of the things that I'm hearing says is that there's the wave of the budget, and that comes from the state, hits down, and then and that is a split. It may be that the state has a different view. They want to privatize education. We are not here for private education. We're here for public education, and we want to reach every youngster. So you have other trends.
Just two other trends, and they actually don't pick up on what you just said, but I'm going to throw them out there anyway, and we can go with them or not.
I have two others that are different.
I mean, there's a lot of trends we can identify, but three long-term trend. Clearly, the poverty levels in our schools are much higher, and short-term actually they've been pretty stable, but we used to call a 30% poverty school a high poverty school, and now we call it 50%.
50.
Yeah, and, well, you know, 40, 50, something like that. But a 30 is not a high poverty school by any means. But the two other trends is, number one is our teaching force is getting younger, less experienced, a lot of retirements, a lot of people, and that's significant impact on our classrooms. And the other one is one that is related also to state policy, which is that open enrollment has gotten a lot easier. And we're seeing a lot of open enrollment leavers. And this year there's a change in special education open enrollment reimbursements, which could also have some serious, but it is going to have some impacts on budgets. And, you know, I'm never one, I've always concentrated on that we educate the children who are in our schools. And the economics of open enrollment are not as simple as they seem on the surface, but in terms of how well we're serving our community, it's something that you have to be aware of. And we're seeing those numbers, and we're seeing those numbers steady grow, and a lot of that is because state policy has made it easier. A lot easier.
But
the desire was there.
It's
but
about
the,
1%, right?
What's that?
It's about 1%.
Yeah, it's about 1%. And private enrollment's growing a little bit, but it's relatively steady. Yeah. Budgetarily, these, you know, 200 students, yeah. 400 students, changes calculations.
No, yeah, no question.
It changes
no question.
Calculations. Yeah. And also, it's just the image-wise that it's something, you know, that... So those are two trends I wanted to throw out there. There are three, if you want to count the poverty one, which is a long-term trend.
I've got two others. One was that at least on school board levels, and I believe a growing number of people in the community are beginning to understand that the achievement gap issue is complex and requires a comprehensive approach. It's never as simple as what's going on in the classroom. From my mind, if that was it would have been solved a long time ago. We have good teachers. But it's complex, partly because of the impact of poverty, of trauma on among many of our students. The Madison School District's 5% of our children are homeless, and the majority of children that get homeless is mainly due to abuse, domestic abuse in houses, and all kinds of other traumatic experiences. 5%, fully 5% in a class that's 24 are in it, and then what happens with someone like that is they come to where they feel the safest to act out, and that happens in your school district. So the other trend that school districts, the good ones around the country, are beginning to recognize is that we need to increase the level of mental health services that we're providing to those children that are acting up the most in our schools for whatever the reasons that exist. So those are things that we've recognized, and I consider us a good school board. But we're trying to seriously address everything that can get into the way of any kid that their achievement. And so the achievement gap, as we talked about it for years now, I think is finally being addressed comprehensively, and I think more people in the community are beginning to understand that as well.
I wonder if sometimes the trends more of an issue than a trend. I mean, are there things that other state agencies can take and it should be, yes, an issue. Mental health is one. That the county sponsors the mental health services, and they have been very positive about it, but they've decreased their budget in providing mental health
services. They've increased it for the schools. A new program this year partnered with the county, us, and is it United Way? That's
Catholic Charities, and
Catholic Charities got the contract
is the main provider, and
to increase
there's money from which foundation? I can't remember. but there's some foundation money there too.
Enough policymakers at the local level are beginning to pick up the slack for the state that's trying to withdraw services and get into unfortunate type of decisions where they have to cut mental health budgets for the mass public, but understanding the critical need to address it at an early age by creating a new program. So we're funding it, others fund it. And it's absolutely essential that we do this.
So it's a partnership that is being developed to address this issue, and that's an issue.
These types of partnerships, particularly between school boards, city councils, and county boards, are imperative.
Yeah,
that's
it's
where the money is.
It's actually, I think it's unprecedented, the level of collaboration that we have now between the city, the county, and schools. I don't ever recall it being, and I think it's recognition on each entity's part that they need to contribute, and I think that's one of the probably the positive trends that we're seeing is that collaboration. I think collaboration across entities is a very positive trend. It's a good thing because schools can't do it all themselves. There's no way. And finally, I think our community is beginning to realize that. And you know, I'm quick to remind our community the reason why we are where we are is because of the mindset we used to be in. And that is that we focused so long on poverty and poor parenting as they were like crutches, and we sort of said, well, you know, certain groups of students just cannot achieve because of poverty and poor parenting. And finally, that's gone by the wayside. Obviously, poverty is a factor, and poor parenting is too. But we can never say why we can't educate kids. It has to be that we can educate everyone, and that's a very new paradigm. And that's where we need to be.
I just want to flag, picking up on James' flag, one of the biggest collaborations is one that really has not been, it'll start to look more public this summer, but the Medicine Out of School Time Project, which is a partnership with the city to provide information and professional development for out-of-school time programs and to provide a kind of a one-stop for parents and families in the community for how to find the right programs. Eventually, we hope to have an evaluation piece of it to you know, like quality of programs and help people improve the quality of programs. We hope to have one-stop stuff where if you qualify for free or reduced services, you only have to do that once, so you don't have to go from program to program to program. And so that's, you know, that's been in the works for 3 years now.
Yeah.
I mean, and
the staff that runs it is jointly paid by our budget and the city council budget. So that's a very a great example of a coordinated budget through a program that will impact not only all families in the city, but all of our students as well.
And the biggest provider is MSCR. I mean, that's, you know, and that's us. You know, I mean, that, you know,
And that's one of the advantage that Madison has. Most cities' recreation is not under the school. In Madison, it is under the school. And that partnership that has developed all the way in the last 10 years has been very crucial to provide some service.
It's a good partnership. I'm a little critical of it, though.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I feel that kids should have preference. And what we, because of budgets, we're putting the preference on adults because they can pay. And so I think we're seeing a crowding out effect where kids are not getting access, and when kids don't get access, they're not as engaged. And engagement is probably the biggest key to kids' success. Can we engage some of these kids? Can they become engaged in their schools? And so I have an issue there because I think it's very imbalanced because of budgets. We want to raise money. Parents can pay. So a lot of adult programs, and I'm fine with adult programs, but not when they crowd out kids. I think we have to emphasize kids. And I think
that's a good example where Mr. Flores kind of brought up last year the idea of football, mm-hmm. and how to use that as a way to buy so every middle school could have a football team. Mm-hmm. Now, medicine is very unique because in the past, football teams were developed by clubs, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. not until 1990s was starting to develop a club for the youngsters who could not afford that high pay to play football.
Well, I think that's one of the things that goes to is that it's not only in this, but in other areas, we have these public-private relationships, which makes it hard to do coordination. You know, where I grew up, there was a recreation department, and there was the equivalent of a Warner Park kind of recreation center in every neighborhood. And instead, you know, we've got, okay, well, if you live here, you go to the YMCA. If you live there, you go to the Boys and Girls Club. If you live here, you've got the Atwood Center. If you've got, and some of these are public, some of these are private. There's no one, and part of Madison out of school time, at least in the out of school portion, is trying to look at, like, getting some coordination because maybe one has an interest or capacity in one area, and, you know, and so these programs are available here. But across town, whoever the provider is doesn't have that interest. And when you don't have one entity except for MSCR, which MSCR is across the board, but MSCR is limited in terms of our facilities. We use the schools, essentially, in Hoyt, and we've got the New East Side location, which is actually a rental, but it's a long-term rental. So I think that there's advantages and disadvantages that come with this. And I think that that's one of the things that, and the other thing is that it makes our budget look bigger. does, you know?
More cities that have a steady recreation, they have their advantages and disadvantages. You take, for example, Chicago. Yeah. Chicago has a relationship with the school district that every youngster who is in a poverty area gets to experience 1 week in a camp. And they finance that. But then we have cities that don't get that advantage. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to go. And decision makers are the ones who help us decide how it's going to happen.
I'll point to one of James's favorite examples, which is swimming pools, right?
What's that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's that we got one
Goodman.
Public pool.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's it. And then we've got, you know, then we've got Lapham and we've
beaches.
Got the high school pools, but.
Summer beaches, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But if you look at. The high school swim teams, they're predominantly white.
Absolutely.
And you know why that is, at least in my view, and this is my issue with access, because I think people have to get a broader view of access, because access is really an economic issue. Because what happens is, and I use my own son as an example, although he swam in high school, he wasn't technically, physically probably the most gifted kid on the team. Technically, he hit that wall and lose 5 seconds. You know, he wasn't good on the wall, you know. And where does that come from? That comes from being in these clubs, practicing. Who are in the clubs? The people that can afford to pay for them. Okay. Now, I could have done it with myself. We just didn't do it. But the minority kids, they're not going to be in the clubs. So what happens when they get to high school? It's competitive. They're not on the team. Mm-hmm. See? And so that's my issue with access. See, we talk about access. Access is an economic issue. Because if you don't have access in the early years, if you can't get access, you're not going to be there in the later years. So now you don't have a chance at scholarships and a lot of other things that's available to the kids with access. Mm-hmm. And so when you go to these schools and you see these programs that are white, that's because parents have been able to afford to put their kids in these clubs all through their lives. And so now they can compete as they get to that higher level.
Right,
it's a real issue.
James and I do these days. I just have to put in my plug for the Goodman Waves at this point. James and I had this conversation before. And I've been involved, my family's been involved in the Goodman Waves, and there are not only scholarships, but it's partially privately funded, and it's affordable, and outreach has been done. The outreach hasn't been as successful as it could be for a variety of reasons. One is because it doesn't offer a lot of low-income families are looking for full-day programming, and this would just be morning. And so that makes a difference. But, and that's another issue of access is what, you know, I need my kids to be someplace all day, right? Because I got to be at work. Right. Whereas other families can be, okay, you do a half day here, you know, we'll hire someone, we'll hire a babysitter to take care of the afternoon, that kind of stuff. That's access too.
Yes.
And the other, another interesting thing around athletics is that there hadn't been any board discussion around athletics in probably years. Other than when we talked about it recently, were you aware?
It's been years. We hadn't had one.
It's been a long time.
We actually told the administration to go back, and they're going to put it on our agenda, I think, in May. And I've been talking with Mike and James about this, and I'm actually going to introduce a resolution that we set up an athletic advisory board. Similar to what MSCR has, that all four ADs have to go to with this board, and they develop policies primarily. The first one being access, and then coordination among all their high schools, and how that they can expand it into the middle school. And I think I see the potential for raising large dollars for support for our athletic programs here. And what we did find out when we asked our staff to look at this is that every student that's involved in athletics academically does better. Every single one of them. So if we can expand that opportunity, particularly to kids that have limited access at an earlier level, this is an opportunity for us to create that hook with the kid and then let them ride that through.
It is a bonding.
Hey, welcome, by the way.
Hi, Don.
It is a bonding decision where the school and the recreation are trying to bond for the benefit of the kids. I mean, when you talk about access, it comes to mind, for example, tennis. There's only a club, and the club decided to do some kind of a foundation to sponsor youngsters how to learn how to play tennis. Now, why do some students don't have the ability to play tennis? Because they are not having the access. So I think that's a very, very crucial issue to bring up. And I know that the recreation department has evolution with that, because in the past, 20 years ago, to talk about football, competitive sports, it was a no-no in the recreation board. So now you're talking that you can bring it down to the board and start talking about being some kind of a committee and advisory.
But Dean, isn't one of the issues the lack of programs in middle school and elementary schools? You know, when our friends' kids grew up in Verona, for example, those coaches had programs early on, and those schools had.
They're not coordinated.
Well, that's what it's completely different. Yeah, it pretty much not existed.
Can I ask you a quick question? You're talking about kids doing better when they're participating in sports. The first thing that pops in my mind is why 3 years ago did MMSD put the grade level for participation from a C average to a D average?
Knife.
I have two high school kids, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm curious about that because part of the reason I think was to make sure that more kids could participate, but the flip side is...
What's the message?
Well, three years later,
what we saw is that grade point averages of all kids involved were higher.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah. What's the reason?
I can tell you. Well, I have two juniors, and my kids played football, and I can tell you that there's a different grading scale for athletes versus non-athletes.
What does that mean? You mean that there's some discretion in the system? Is that what you're saying?
There's more than discretion. And I'm not just talking the lower level kids, I'm talking the upper level kids too.
Well, I have a hard time with that one, you know, and I would really rail against that. I mean, I have a hard time. That's really to say that kids that are participating in athletics are really not as good as academically as the kids that are not participating. And I can't support
no,
that.
I wouldn't.
My daughter's carried a 3.8, and I see how hard she works, and I would not insult her that way at all. Because it's shocking to me that she's doing so well, And she's, you know, I don't want to get into where she is on that, on the scale of athletics, but she's a D1 recruit, already been recruited as a sophomore, and all the kids across the spectrum. And this whole thing about a D average, I'm going to look into that because that bothers me.
If it that's started a rule, when my kids were freshmen.
If that's a rule, that's an issue for me.
The dovetail that I was going to ask you is, have you as a board looked at other things like debate, drama, other programs within the school, and do those kids academically do better because they participate in those kind of activities?
Yes, we looked at that across the board.
I guess that's what I'm saying. It always scares me when we just say athletics. Can we all, do you see the same results in
other areas? Let's use the word extracurricular.
That's much better.
Which, of course, is part of. Kids that participate in extracurricular do better.
But
here's my question, and I can't answer this question. The question is, do they do better because they're in extracurricular, or do better kids just go in extracurricular? That one I can't answer. I don't know.
Both.
We do know.
Both.
Okay.
Both.
Well. Okay. I haven't seen the data that answers the question.
But I guess if you frame it as extracurricular versus sports.
And that's
I
the way we frame. That's really where we frame it. But we got to talk about sports here.
We just started on that.
That's the way we frame it. We're talking about extracurricular because you're absolutely right. You're talking about music and all other arts. I mean, but that's what you find is that, and that's at least in my case. That's what's going on with my daughter. She loves basketball so much, she's studying her ass off.
Sure. She
simple?
Wants to be able to play.
She wants to be able to play.
Makes perfect
sense. And of my three kids, she was the one that we thought that we were going to struggle like heck with. And I was shocked. You know, I'd be perfectly honest with you.
Good parents. I know a kid who's doing the same thing because she got hooked into music.
Yeah.
If that's what I'm saying. You're right. It's the hook.
You're right. Remember, Scott. Scott used to run a group at the East High School, Kojo.
Oh, yeah.
And boy, that group, he could testify, as I already said, once the youngsters engage in something, they could do much better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he hit up 50, 40 youngsters all the time that they were in the Kojo, and those youngsters did much better.
Yeah.
And the same thing for drama, the same thing for all the band, art, debate, the same thing.
So
youngsters need this bonding.
The common thread seems to be engagement. If kids can find a reason to be engaged, that they'll typically do better. And that's the big piece that's been missing for a lot of the impoverished kids, the low-income kids. And that gets into the strategic framework. And these are controversial pieces in there, and I'm going to bring up one of TJ's controversial pieces. That's the one around career pathways. Now, I think career pathways is a way of really getting kids engaged. Because one of the criticisms kids have is that, for example, you're seeing a big conversation now that's starting to play out nationwide around algebra. And, why are we taking
deja vu.
Seen
this before.
But career pathways is about, how do you get kids engaged? Can you get them in something that they can really identify with and say, well, I'm in school because I'm going to end up whether it's an electrician, a doctor, whatever. And if they can start seeing that future, and so that's really the hook about career pathways. That's what I'm supporting, and because I've been in this community. One of the things I say is that when you're the worst at something, it's like the best at something. You got to work your butt off to be the best at something. You work pretty hard to be the worst at something, too. And we've been the worst in education around here for kids of color for a long time. And we need to...
99th now in the top 100 cities.
I know. Yes. We need to figure out ways and even take risks, if necessary, to get kids engaged.
Yes. Commonwealth does a very good job. One thing is to do career process. Another thing is developmental processing, developing your vision to the future. How do you discover yourself so you can decide what you're going to do with your... I'm reading this book from Quiñones, rather from my school up in San Antonio, Texas, St. Mary's, and he talks about it in the book. How in the world did he become a journalist if it wasn't for the program they had at the high school for him?
Mm-hmm.
Commonwealth does a very good job. He has a process that takes youngsters, and right now they're interviewing youngsters to place them in a job during the summer. They're doing the pre-employment program, and they're also, last year they contracted with the city with a new program that the mayor developed, which is the internship.
Internships.
We need to do more of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We need to build it up.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to.
They were hoping to get 20, and then when all the departments came back and said it was 40 and growing, so they, we were able to get a lot of kids with some high-level experiences, and hopefully that'll translate back to schools. Okay, then those just say, sometimes say, okay, now I know why I got to do school, because I can get to do that. The pathways, we're only going to be able to start them in two areas, healthcare. Technology is the other one?
Right now, healthcare is the only one that's been picked.
Healthcare is the only, okay. And I would like to see these expanded with all kinds of options. And I believe that they work, because I worked as a teacher in a program just like this, where they went to school in the morning with me, and then in the afternoon they went to their job. Now, we didn't place them with them. They had a choice of getting a job, but those kids came and did their work. They got disciplined. They knew that they get their degree, and then they could continue to live. And it was a program for at-risk kids, because half of them were living on their own already. They had to make their money, but it was working. They came in and got disciplined enough to do the coursework, go to work, live their lives, and graduate. Other kids are just trying to.
We already have the CNA programs and everything else in the high schools. They already have the health care. Programs.
Some
high schools have CNA programs, but this goes beyond that.
Yeah.
It's
going to be James to everybody.
I think that there's things we have to be very careful with a few different aspects of this. Number one is we have to be careful that we don't create pathways that put one type of kid in one direction,
right.
and you know what, you're going to be happy. We're going to put you in the one to have this kind of job, which is never going to pay more than $17 an hour, and it's probably going to disappear because it'll be automated in 3 years. And another kid goes into a pathway this way, and we do that already. But if we're going to do something new, we got to make sure that we're not doing more of that. We have to be careful that we don't lose the good things we have, and the good things we have exist at a lot of different levels. I mean, when we start to talk about that, usually people, you know. The first place most people go, and I'll admit I'll go there too, is things like, you know, we have some very, very high-level and sophisticated electives at both Memorial and West, and to a lesser extent at East, and to an even lesser extent at La Follette. And, you know, these serve affluent kids, they serve things, but there's other things that we have that we can lose too. And, you know, and if we look at some of the kind of the choices that avid kids have to make, just in terms of scheduling, that they can't have access to languages, they can't have as much access to the arts, they can't have access, and these pathways are going to create some scheduling difficulties. Now, we brought in some consultants on the scheduling, and you know, consultants are always, you never know what you're going to get. So far I've heard some okay things about them. We'll find out. But so we have to make sure that we don't lose things that we have, systems of support we have, opportunities that students have. And we also have to make sure that, you know, one of our issues is related to poverty and related to other things is student mobility. And if you create these structured pathways programs, are there places for kids to come into them? You have to think about this stuff in front, because in some sense, you know, you can come into a traditional high school and find the classes and do that kind of stuff. If it's a structured program with prerequisites and building on each other in specialized ways, that's going to be a challenge. So again, I'm not against the pathways. I just think that we have to go slow and careful. And I'm skeptical about, you know, the talk is to do what they're calling wall-to-wall pathways, that every kid is in a designated pathway, and that means with designated structures. I'm skeptical of that as being the goal.
Wow.
I think that improving our vocational things and creating these pathways and having those options out there is a very positive thing. The wall to wall, I'm skeptical on. I'll be honest about it.
I really wish that the consultants would sit down with groups of high school kids and ask them what they think of the new plan
ACP?
That, yeah. The
Raphael's
new,
the expert
the
on
new
that.
Go into a pathway because it's. I think that there's. The students actually have some really good ideas on that.
I think you. Yeah, what I'm hearing from the, you is that you got to be very careful how you approach this.
Hell no.
And,
sure.
And I sense that as a group decision. You want to be careful. I like to suggest that youngsters need to be involved in the discussion. I youngsters do have some say so, and they like to kind of direct. When youngsters sometimes hear it, oh, this is what you're going to do, and then later you do something later, they get very confused. And that's I'm talking about differences. Families who have both parents have good income, they don't have that. They're going to succeed either way. And they have that guidance all the way until they get to master's degree.
But one of the things is we're talking 13, 14-year-old kids. And, you know, you can put a lot of weight on kids, but they're for kids. And so, yes, we should, opportunities for input. Kids should be involved in making, in the district-wide decision-making and certainly their personal decision-making, but they're kids. I mean, I'm a father of a 14-year-old. And, you know, and there's things I'm not going to let him decide, you know, because he's 14.
And that's the point.
And I think that we have to be careful with that. But I do think that having the student input is important.
An answer to your last question is what is one way where strong partnership from families, and that's this program particularly, families are going to have to really educate themselves about it as well to provide their child with the experience that they think will work best for them.
Exactly.
It's a good idea without... Your experience now with a 14-year-old, I remember when I was 14, I would have no clue what to pick. I would, you know, I said, I just want to play baseball. Let me go hang out with a baseball.
14, I have a pathway.
Putting on the 14-year-old back of saying, you need to make your decision at 13 and 14.
But we don't know that that's really the way it's going to work.
Yeah, and
so
it's not,
we should
what's
not.
What's they're doing right now?
Kids are already feeling that.
That's what
some
they're doing
kids.
Right now. That's what you're doing every Monday afternoon right now.
But what's happening every Monday afternoon?
They meet as a grade level in a class, and the focus is, what are you going to be when you grow up? What steps are you going to take? What classes are you going to take? How many
and
tests
you,
can
you
they
consider
take
that to be a bad conversation?
I think it's incredibly, I know way too many kids, including my own, the anxiety level is off the charts because they feel like they have to make their decision at 13 and 14 of what they're going to be for the rest of their lives.
But, you know, I have that conversation with my kids, but I don't put that kind of pressure on them. While we're having a conversation, I also tell them that you don't have to make that decision right now, but you got time. Just like my son is a freshman in high school, I say, you don't even have to decide what your major is, you know, as a freshman.
College.
Yeah, as
freshman
a freshman, you know. So, yeah.
But they have an entire class once a week, every week, that's what they do.
Is this Avid or is it a regular
class?
No,
this is the ACP stuff.
This is the new...
I think that's exactly
what
we're...
Does the teacher come across like with Hammer and Nissen, or are they allowing...
It's not just the teacher, it's everybody. Yeah, the stress level is off the charts with the kids.
There are 26 schools that are being researched into that from the Department of Public Instruction. And right now what is coming out is one thing is talking curriculum. Mm-hmm. And the curriculum that anybody can do. And that's what's happening. You talk about curriculum, that's exactly what you're talking about. It's the curriculum that brings questionnaires. Here's a stimulation of where you're going to be. Another thing is to talk the pedagogy to awake the youngsters self-will, what would I like to do? How do you imagine
sure.
it?
Right.
They're two different things. Mm-hmm. And we're stuck in the curriculum and not on the pedagogy. The pedagogical part is distributed through math, science, social studies, and the youngster welcomes that from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. But what is happening right now is only curriculum on the career pathways. And that's not very suitable nor healthy. Sometimes.
And that's not, you know, that's not what anyone wants to be happening, including the people doing the work. And I think those are difficult things to overcome. And you know, the
resources, you know, right now in the pathways proper, the academic and career planning's kind of been going forward, but the pathways proper, you know, this year is a planning year. We don't implement till next year.
Yeah.
And so we're a year away from seeing how this actually looks in the schools. Yeah. But you know, I do know that from talking from people at the high schools, just the resources and the awareness and the work that goes there, that people are already worried even though they have a whole year. Now maybe they're just worrisome people. Maybe they're just people who worry.
you're not looking at the stress level and the pressure that's being put on
the students.
People like, well, not just the students, but I'm thinking the roles of the guidance counselors, the extra workload that's being put on them to meet with each and every student to discuss what they want to do next year, and each and every student to discuss what they could do after college. And it's not just only the group. But then they also have to do one-on-one meetings, and that really takes a lot of resources.
We did increase the allocation a little bit.
Yeah. You look at the guidance counselors, and God bless them.
I get where James is coming from on this, but I understand the difficulties because I see upper-income parents who have difficulties with their kids, just as you're describing low-income parents. I mean, I get that. But,
and one of the issues is that. And this is an issue. I mean, when you start implementing these new programs, you run into all kinds of problems. I just wish we could implement programs that go smoothly and it works the way you plan it. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, no.
You're going to have issues like you're talking about. And what really I think has to happen is we have to come around the table like this and talk about it and say, you know, how do we resolve these stress factors and all? Because it's just not, you know, we see this in so many programs in the district. We sit there and say, when the hell are we going to implement something that really works the way we want it to work? Yeah. It just doesn't happen like that. I don't care. Even major corporations, look at the rollout of the Obamacare, all the problems they had now. I mean, so everywhere on every level, you have these implementation problems. I'm a hardliner because I know where we are as a district and where we've been. And if we start worrying about, so I mean, you know, sure, we don't want the stress levels and all of that, but somehow, you know, I don't want to end up where we are. That is the worst in the nation of everything when we start talking about minority kids. So what do? You know, we can sit back and say, well, you know, we've got a little more stress here and there. Let's get around the table, figure out maybe how we resolve some of that. But you have to push forward. Otherwise, you know, how do you get out of this where we are? We're the worst in the nation. You know, aren't we tired of that? Yeah. I mean, so how do you do? What's the solution?
So along those lines, I thank you for putting this together. I have one question: how did we decide to expand Hamilton, our least diverse school, when you have space at other schools nearby, like Cherokee? I mean, that to me, to your point, for all kinds
of
reasons,
it's Hamilton and Van Hise to begin with, and they're both not terribly diverse schools to say the least.
Right.
I
was shocked.
The demographic projections show that, you know, number one is that the expansion there is not going to. Essentially, it's to deal with the population that's already there.
But we also have a significant number. I think it was 15% that were transferring within the district to those schools.
Well, right.
Yeah, well, that's my point. I mean, the message we send with
it
that,
Finally put a stop to that.
Yeah, I mean, we've tightened up on that a lot. Schools. We've tightened that up a lot.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, this year we're going to be looking at, well, this in kind of, it's a year and a half, 2 year process. Looking at facilities in general, I don't think, and I think that will include looking at school boundaries. It's got to.
Yes.
And
the last time it was done was 17 years ago, I think.
Yeah, but we're still going to need that capacity of Van Hise and Hamilton, regardless of what we do with school boundaries. I mean, that's the reality, that the demographic projections in that neighborhood, the building projections in that neighborhood, and so it's not an investment to keep a segregated school. It's an investment that we need the facilities regardless. And the next step is looking at boundaries. And there's no question that we need to look at.
Part of the issue no one wants to talk about and admit is that all those white people going over there are going to leave the district if you don't allow them to go
into
Hamilton.
They're not white. Excuse me, I'm a landlord in that area.
Hamilton?
They are not white at all.
What's the demographic?
No.
What's more Asian then?
They're Asian.
Well, we're talking about
they're all connected with the university.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And they all want their children yes. to
okay. That's a huge Asian yeah. population. Yeah. Yeah.
But
you're
not
absolutely
only
right.
That
but still, when we're talking yeah. about that group of folks, yeah. those yeah. are the mobile parents. Those are the ones that are able to. And it's, and these are the way we've made decisions in the district, too. We're trying to keep our white parents, because when you look at the demographics,
we're leaving. I know how we get here.
And so this is how we're leaving. So when you start talking about why these schools are overcrowded, they don't want those Asians or whites to leave. Yeah. And so they make sure they make these concessions.
And you know what, Jim, I'm going to give you a little bit more honest answer, a little fuller answer here, is that when we started talking about doing the facilities, the kind of thing sure. we did at this point, which wasn't really a building, but you know, kind of like a little
working around the edges. Yeah.
You know, board members insisted that we need to look at boundary changes as part of this.
Yeah, I remember that.
And we got an analysis, and it was not a great one. Mm-hmm. It was not a thorough one. But we were looking at deadlines then that decisions mm-hmm. had to be made, mm-hmm. and you know, we said this that and collectively, some of it unspoken, I think many of us said, look at. If we're going to do this referendum, we need to go to the next steps on it now. We don't have time to go back and get a different boundary analysis and go deeper into it. We actually, I think, rejected the first one, and the second one wasn't without that much mm-hmm. better. And at that point, and in fact, you know, one of the maps, and just months later, I was looking at it, and the map was like didn't reflect that the Cherokee, the Lincoln Midvale feeder pattern optional area correctly. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a problem. But so I think that we could have done better at that. We tried. For whatever reasons, we didn't get.
It's very hard.
And we really didn't want to go into a huge boundary redraw at that point. Mm-hmm. And essentially what our staff told us is that there's no simple way. Mm-hmm. We didn't push too hard to say, well, there's some relatively mm-hmm. simple ways. And I think, you know, I remember looking around the room and looking at James and looking at Ed, and they're kind of looking, and we're all kind of like, do we want to push this now? And it was like, you know what, we have needs here, and we got to address them. So that's a little more honest answer.
But this is the time. I mean, given what you see here, this is the time to do it.
It's hard.
We are doing this. We're doing the long-term assessment. And we knew that was happening.
We have to do that.
So you know, if we didn't know that was happening, then we would have pushed that.
It really troubles.
People's memories disagree with mine. That's
it's a boundary change issue.
It's been a long time, but
you
have to do it. We have the district. This community has to do it.
We have to.
We have to do it, and it's going to be painful. But
that's okay. I'm learning, and I'm new to all of this, and I'm here. You know, we all come with different agendas, but I'm hearing things like access. There's severe problems with segregation, racism. Part of me wonders if the school district just doesn't reflect the larger problem in the city.
Of course.
So we've got to figure out a way to somehow educate throughout, and the school district and the city and the county, like you said earlier, all have done a great job of trying to, you know, keep communication lines open. I'm here because I wanted to advocate, and I don't have a ton of experience in this, but with referenda, financial referenda, to start addressing some of these issues, I think we could ask the City of Madison residents, I'm one myself, for a large increase in operational funding, not just capital funding, which you guys did, when was that?
Last year. It'll be a year ago next week.
We package these issues as access, as, you know, equality, as let's not lose 40 more staff, which is what's going to happen soon, right? We need at least 70. To keep the status quo.
70.
Yeah. It's bad. We're in a bit of crisis mode because you mentioned the 20% funding and the poverty, and now there's housing crisis for 20 million Americans where they're unsure if they're going to have a home next month. We're dealing with some larger issues here, but I think in Madison we could put together a referendum that would be sizable if we sell it properly and as equity, as programs, whether it's career track or, I think that with the help of the city, the county, the teachers and AFSCME members. I mean, this would be a slam dunk. That's my opinion. I've seen referendums.
How many referendums have we done now?
Jackie and I served together in opinion schools. We've been through...
Well, the three of us met on the equity task.
We haven't lost one, but the one before we got involved lost, and that was 2005.
Two of the three went down. 2005, yeah. Two of the three went down.
I think you're hitting at the right approach.
That was the rainwater era, too.
People don't understand the finance at all. Mm-hmm. And second of all, it's.
I'm gonna say three things. Number one is I think we have to go through to a referendum again, and I don't know what the timeline looks like. Number two is I think we need to have, I think we need to do a better job with transparency and community involvement in budgeting, and that goes to what Jackie says, that
please,
people don't understand
yes.
it.
Yes.
And I think that things have actually, some things have gotten better and some things have gotten worse in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. What's gotten better is that we've got better information about kind of school level spending and things like that, but it's not coming at the point in the process where it's actionable or it becomes very difficult. And we don't have...
it's not a new issue.
No, but well, that information wasn't available,
right.
period, before.
We never saw it yet.
So yeah. I mean, I think that's a major improvement as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But it's got to come earlier in the process, mm-hmm. and particularly school-level staffing issues. And, you know, I kind of fought that both in public and behind the scenes this year and didn't get much with it. And number three is I think that we need opportunities... For community input. Someone was at the board meeting on Monday talking to us about that, and real kind of, you know, deliberation, and not, you know, none of us, the seven people on the board, aren't going to vote this way and do something because people tell them to, but we need to give people an opportunity to be involved, and I don't think we have enough of that now. I don't think we're ever going to have enough of that, but I think we need to do more of it, and so I think that before we can do a referendum, we need to be in a better place as far as our communications and our involvement. And then the third piece goes to, and I know you're a union guy, Thor, is that current state law says that we can only give raises to our staff, our unionized staff. We can give any kind of raises to anyone else, but our unionized staff based on CPI, Consumer Price Index. And I think that unless you go to a referendum, and I think
that's
we have to
true.
Build in...
Go ahead.
Yeah, it is.
No, you can go above the CPI. The union can't bargain for it.
As long if we... if.
No, I've worked with counties and cities.
That have gone above it?
Yeah, what I do is I go to the bargaining table and I say, you know, we want to bargain for that 0.73.
0.56 this year.
Yeah.
0.03 by January 1, 0.13 by January 1.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's getting really bad. But then I say, I want to stop negotiating now, if that's okay with you guys, and I want to educate you on how you can pay more to your employees because I know you care for them. And some employers agree to that, and others don't. But when they agree to it,
we'll have to go to this conversation.
Yeah, well, we go to meet, confer, and I say, you know what, give me your non-representative.
So there's a way around this.
Let me just finish my thought, and then I'll shut up. Which is that... no school district has done this yet to go to a referendum to give above CPI. Oregon School District almost did it and then pulled back at the last minute because they were redesigning their compensation system, and they ran into some kind of roadblocks on that, and they said, you know what, we're not going to do this unless we're doing it right. But nobody's done it yet. And I think that if we do it, we need to go to the voters and say, look, you know, are our staff worth a raise? As part of the conversation.
And I think the fourth piece of that goes back to our active task force days, and that was one of the things that was really important to everybody in the room, was that each school was equally desirable. We have too many situations with referendums and everything else, and this last referendum was a perfect example of, my school's not getting this, my school's getting this, we had to privately fundraise for this, you're just getting handed this, and we tear each other apart. And what's really
our
frustrating
is blah blah blah.
Well, but it's frustrating to me to find out that there's programs that I take for granted at Memorial that aren't at East. That's not fair. I mean, you know, when you look at it at an equity, it should not matter if the child lives by Memorial or East or La Follette or wherever. They should have the same educational opportunities. Period. Whether it be
AP classes, whether it be, you know, different journeyman opportunities, whatever. And I think
and that's the
problem with the county is we've lost so many kids to the outlying counties. Again, you have to get the parents together to work together to make all of our schools and sell all of our schools as equal.
Question, Jackie, really quick,
is that we've had slowly growing enrollment and relatively steady enrollment. So losing kids is kind of a funny phrase. Now this year we're down like 100, we're down 70. Next year we're down 130 in our projections. So we are actually. But, so, you know, I know that there are families not sending their school kids to the schools, but our enrollment numbers overall have been relatively steady.
The last thing I wanted to say about the referendum, are we making progress on benchmarking our academic improvements year to year and saying, hey, we're going to spend another $50 million. Are we going to get more kids reading or whatever the issue?
I think that's a very good question. I think
it's been a topic for 20 years.
That's really a strong conversation that's going on behind the scenes, because we're talking about exactly what we like to see in terms of those kinds of improvements. And I totally agree, we have to look at that. But, you know, I don't even want to get all into this map measurement thing that the board have a lot of issues with. Yeah, whether or not we graduate, you know, I want to know if we graduate more kids, who's graduating, what's the GPA, just some of the basic stuff that we all look at as parents and people to say, you know, we're doing better. Look at your GPA. You know, when you start talking about math growth and all, I think you lose 95% of everybody in society, you know, in the community, you know. So we have to do better. It's all right to have math, but let's have the other stuff too.
There's two pieces. One is what are we reporting as a general thing? How is data being presented? And number two is what measures are being privileged? We had a long conversation at one of our retreats about these combined issues. You could get a freedom of information on it, but in a message to the board 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, the administrators came up with a response which changes some of the general reporting but doesn't change the privileged measures, and the board has not met on this since then, so I have no idea what anyone else thinks about it. I mean, we've all kind of looked at it, and I'll have to say that, you know, since it's not on an agenda, I skimmed it, made some mental notes, and said, you know, got to get back to this, and I'm sure that's what everybody else did too. But this is something that, what are the right measures? And, you know, you mentioned GPA. We're looking at things like, you know, high school course failures. And then, you know, the thing is, well, you know, does that create pressure to give kids D's who aren't learning? There's a chance.
Of course.
And so what kind of measures are we looking at here is something that I think that, and how we communicate these measures to the community. And honestly, because I believe that if we don't face our failures, we're not going to address them. Mm-hmm. So I don't want the rose-colored glasses on this. I don't want the, oh, look at, you know, we found growth here, here, and here, and those are going to be the headline.
Yeah.
Because to me, that does, the challenges we face are enormous.
Yeah, and that's what we found.
Yeah.
There's little ticks.
I actually read the thing. Yeah, the public. Yeah.
One thing we didn't talk about, and this is a huge issue for me, is the whole issue of competitiveness. And we don't talk enough about competitiveness, because when you talk about declining budgets, the only way budgets other than referendums is going to stay stable or increase is through
enrollment growth.
And
yep.
So, yes. You know, for me, we as community people here in Madison, we want our schools to be solid. Even the things we don't like, we have to really be careful how we talk about them. Because, and I used to be one that would like rail against things, but we have finicky parents, and some are very mobile. And so these parents will flee. And so you have to really think about, I mean, we're sitting here right in the middle of some very good school districts. And so how do you talk about these things in public? See, and I think that's something we really have to think about, because, we want to make sure that we talk about them and be as forceful about them, and we need to have the highest levels of achievement as we possibly can. But, you know, how do you in this era of competitiveness that we're in now, and I think we're in this era, and we may, in fact, have also gone into the era of decline in enrollment. We haven't determined that yet, but we may have entered into the era of decline in enrollment. And if that's the case with those state budgets and the decline in enrollments,
it's a death spiral budget.
Yes, indeed.
It is.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah.
The good argument for the referendum is we want to stay competitive.
Yeah. Well, that only goes so far, though. I mean, the reason Madison has a strong tax base now is Epic Systems. Imagine this economy without taxpayer and health insurance funded Epic System. I mean, there's no way we wouldn't be having this chat. I've been in Detroit a number of times the last few years. I mean, there's a lot of cities that they just lose it. So thinking that this level of spending will continue for 10 years, I mean, maybe.
No.
I don't know.
No.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, it's cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, it's a pleasure.
And I think we have to do this more often.
Yes.
Can
see you, Rafael.